from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Vaseli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today, I'll get a preview of the Ronan Chamber Ensemble's upcoming season.
I'll get to sample the new book, Indiana, One Pint at a Time.
You better share. I'll catch up with the Indianapolis Opera. And, of course, we'll also have our arts calendar we call What Do We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. The Ronan Chamber Ensemble was founded by clarinetist David Billman and cellist Ingrid Fisher Billman to perform the great chamber repertoire for winds and strings, both well-loved and contemporary. David Billman dropped in to tell Sharon about Ronan's new season and how he and his colleagues keep their inspiration after 27 years.
I can't believe it's been almost three decades. How did the time go by so fast?
We don't know either. it's been lots packed in there, including our daughter growing up and being in medical school now. And so, yeah, it's been a number of years.
When you formed your ensemble, did you think, hope, dream it would have a life parallel to your ISO careers for decades? Or did you not look in the crystal ball at the time?
Yeah, I don't think we really predicted too much ahead. We were thinking about the specific need at the time. We started out at the Lyman and Snodgrass Galleries on Delaware Street, and they expressed an interest in having some chamber music in their lovely room there, and we provided that for a few years. Of course, it's been quite a number of years since we were there, and that gallery no longer exists. But no, I don't think at the time we really thought that far down the road.
I assume that since you're married to your co-founder, you have a pretty good institutional memory, but do you have an actual list somewhere of the repertoire of all 26 seasons?
Well, it's interesting you ask that. I don't think so. I know we compiled that after 10 years, I believe, maybe after 20, but we certainly haven't updated it since 20. So that's probably something we really ought to do. But it would be a pretty long list, and including a number of Indiana composers that we've commissioned and had pieces written for us. And so, yeah, it would be fairly lengthy by now.
Yeah. As someone who is deeply engaged with not only performing but also programming your concerts, do you have a formula or kind of a rough outline of how often to repeat something?
I don't know. I wouldn't classify it as a formula, but yeah, we try not to put something on certainly more than every 5 or 6 years. It, you know, there are certain pieces like the Mozart Clarinet Quintet, which we will play this year, that is worth hearing certainly every
Absolutely.
5 or 6 years. But we're also always interested in new repertoire that we discover, and so there's always something fresh on the docket.
Speaking of new repertoire, you have done a lot of commissions over the years. You're up in double digits on commissions, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, I believe we're somewhere close to 20 by now. Mm-hmm. And we will be repeating one of those this year, a work by Christopher Rutkowski, who was on the faculty at University of Indianapolis. He's written actually a couple of pieces for us. We're going to do the work named Passages, and we'll open our Ronin Goes Klezmer concert with that piece, because it the first movement, Halakha, which is the Hebrew word for law, basically, utilizes an actual klezmer tune, and he harmonizes it in a very Bartokian, interesting sort of way, but the klezmer mood is definitely there, and it makes a great way to open that concert.
And that's a very lively way to start a season, too. I mean, klezmer music, even to people who are completely unfamiliar with its cultural background, feels happy, joyous, celebratory, infectious.
Yes. Interestingly enough, the idea to do another one, and we did one some 15 years ago, a klezmer based concert. The idea behind that was from one of our audience members and donors, Virginia Moline, who thought, wouldn't it be great for us to do another klezmer concert? So, and we're going to do in a similar format, but I'm especially excited personally this time because I've taken a couple of tunes that I've always loved from an album by Gyura Feidman, who is, of course, one of the foremost klezmer musicians. He used to be a bass clarinetist in the Israel Philharmonic, but he left the orchestra long ago, and he went on to have quite a career as a klezmer musician. He was brought up in that tradition, and I'm teaching myself a couple of those tunes by ear, which is sort of how it's done, because I don't have the sheet music.
Sure.
That's not a way that I've traditionally learned music over the years, being a symphony musician.
Right, right.
Usually the music is in front of you.
Yeah, so. How you have to shift gears to do that. It's much more, I don't know, freeform is the right expression, but...
But it's an interesting road for me to go down, and I'm
so
enjoying that.
So as you're doing that, are you trying to capture it? Are you trying to transcribe it to paper, or are you just memorizing by ear?
Not yet. I'm trying to learn it. They're not that complex tunes, but as I said, it's just a different concept for me, and I'm having a great time doing it and trying to capture the spirit that he has been able to on these albums.
What a treat.
Yeah, I think so for myself, and the audience gets really enjoys the klezmer tunes. And we'll have, you know, some of the traditional instruments, the guitar, violin, drums, and bass, and Ingrid's going to join in on the cello also, of course.
Cool. Room for dancing at Woodroom at Hilbert Circle Theater if people are so inclined.
Oh, perhaps.
Switching gears, a trio of trios in November. You could say this is going 180 degrees from the spirit of your klezmer concert, I think.
Yeah, this is a much more traditional type of repertoire. And as I said, the one fresh thing that will be on that concert, for a Ronin audience anyways, it's been heard in Indianapolis, but is the trio for oboe, bassoon, and piano of Poulenc. We've never programmed that because there's no part for Ingrid or I in that piece. And, of course, we're the co-founders of Ronin. But it's such a wonderful piece. And just a little aside, I gave myself this concert off because just a few days afterward I'll be playing the Mozart Clarinet Concerto with the ISO, and
you need a little rest before that.
Yeah,
that's an undertaking.
It's a little much. So no clarinet on that concert, but Ingrid will be featured playing in the Beethoven String Trio, and she's going to work with half of the New Century String Quartet for that, a little partnership with Dean Franca and Susan Chen. And the last piece on that concert is something that Ronin has done, but not in many, many years, is the Weber trio for flute, cello, and piano.
Hmm.
That will be, of course, with Rebecca Aronson on flute, who is one of the core members and co-founders of Ronin way back 27 years ago.
Yeah, we should probably stop saying things like that. It's making everyone feel old. Just experienced folks. Not everyone started at, I think you and Ingrid were 11 years old when you started.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I always tell people.
Switching gears again. Oh, and we should mention that your second concert is also at Woodroom, Hilbert Circle Theater.
Right.
But then you're being a little itinerant for the third and fourth concerts, going to the Lilly Theater in the DeHaan Center at U of I, and featuring soprano Kathleen Hacker in your February concert.
Yes, well, it's our first time to perform at the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center, and I've been on the faculty at the university teaching clarinet lessons, and it just seemed like a natural partnership to meld what Ronin does with their faculty artist series, since I am and a number of us regularly participate down there. And Kathleen Hacker, of course, is the director of the School of Music there and a wonderful, wonderful soprano.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to open that concert with something involving flute. We're still working on that one. But the first half of the concert will mostly feature Kathleen Hacker in a little suite of three different chamber settings with soprano. One by Copland and one by Vaughan Williams. And of course, we're going to have, well, not of course, but we're going to present a world premiere by John Berners, who is the composer in residence at the university. And that will be cabaret songs for soprano, clarinet, and Bayan, which is the buttoned version of the accordion.
And that's a combination I'm not aware that there's a deep repertoire for.
I think you're right.
Is that a fair way to say it?
I think that's quite fair. But Marco Petrichik is on the faculty there teaching organ, and he's quite a master of the Bayan, which is, I think, quite popular in his home country. And has performed on the Faculty Arts Series on the Bayan,
mm-hmm.
and we're very much, it should be a real fun set of songs.
What's the source of the text for those? Do we know yet?
I believe John Berners says he'll write one of them, but we don't know more specifically than that. I think he's going to other sources I believe there'll be three songs.
Cool. You know, and sometimes people hear that something is contemporary and they don't realize that contemporary means sometimes it's not being performed for a few months, it's still being written. It's that fresh.
Yeah, and John Berners is one of the composers that we have worked with in the last couple of years, and we're really looking forward to having one of his pieces on again. There's always a real clever sense of humor and lots of fun.
And for the audience members who say, oh, but please give me something I already know every note of, you're ending that with?
That's the concert with the Mozart Clarinet Quintet, and we'll be joined there by Ariana Kim, who is the new violin instructor there. Will join us along with, in this case, Dennis McCafferty, a faculty member there, will be playing cello and not Ingrid, and so it's a real cooperative event between the two entities, the school and the Ronin Chamber Ensemble. I'm very much looking forward to working with Ariana, who I've heard play a number of times down there.
Play nicely together. Speaking of partnerships, the March concert, which I should mention, we're having this conversation in July, and especially the March concert, the repertoire is still being developed, but this is your annual partnership with the violin competition.
Yes, I can't count how many years, but it's been several years that we've worked in tandem and presented one concert a year on their Laureate Series concerts, And this year we'll be working with the bronze medalist from 2002, Soo-Vin Kim. We're very much excited about being able to work with him. And also on that concert will be the ISO's principal double bass player, Rufeng Liu, and she and I will be opening that concert with 8 short pieces by Morten Gool, which he calls Benny's Gig. And of course, as most of your listeners could guess, that's inspired and written for Benny Goodman. And so they're jazz-inspired
yeah.
type of tunes.
Yeah.
And I've played a few of them recently. They're really a lot of fun. Some of them are very introspective and contemplative, but some of them are just straight out swing, and it's going to be a lot of fun to work with Rufeng on that. And she'll of course appear in the last work on that concert, which is Beethoven's septet for winds and strings, and along with Soo-Vin, it's a wonderful vehicle for the violinist in that piece. And of course Ingrid will be playing, and we'll have some other players on bassoon and horn and
it's a great piece.
Viola. Yeah.
Great piece.
Really super. And that's been, again, at least 6-7 years since Ronin did that.
Never too soon to hear that one again in my book. So don't let me do your programming, or I'd put a couple things from the current season on every season.
And that one, I think you mentioned, but that one is at the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana History Center, and it's in the Frank and Katrina Bazile Theater within
Easy
that
for
building.
You to say.
Yes, exactly.
Long names there. Long names, great acoustic, great venue, too.
Gamble, it's David Bellman, co-founder of the Ronin Chamber Ensemble. Find out more at roninchamber.org. That's R-O-N-E-N chamber.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Not that we need to justify our interview today, but Travis did ask me to remind you that his subject deals with significant historical issues, as well as providing insights into contemporary craftsmanship. And it tastes good, too. The subject is Indiana Crafted Beer, and Travis DiNicola's guests were here to talk about the new book, Indiana, One Pint at a Time. Author Douglas Wissing, designer Patricia Prather, and Ray Boomhauer, senior editor at the Indiana Historical Society Press, all bellied up for this interview.
Pat, Ray, Douglas, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have the three of you here today.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Thanks. Let me start with Pat. As you're a designer at Dean Johnson, this book sort of began at Dean Johnson in many ways, correct?
Correct.
I mean, you would think it would begin in a bar somewhere, but...
Well, actually, it probably did.
Well,
one of my colleagues, Mike Schwab, and Bruce Dean came up with this idea. It was their brainchild. They wanted to do a book on Indiana breweries, and we immediately thought of Douglas because of his past in breweries, with beer, I suppose, and that's how it all got started. We just, we had been designing books for the Indiana Historical Society for years,
and working with Ray,
we really enjoyed the work, and so that's why we wanted to do a book of our own.
Okay. And obviously you guys enjoy beer, too.
Oh, yes,
right,
of course.
Which is just a given here. Douglas, tell me about your, as Pat said, your background in breweries.
That sounded a little more lurid than it should have. I had written a number of articles for national publications on a famous Trappist brewery in Belgium called Westerlederen that was ranked as the number one beer in the world. And it's a really remote place, and they only sell at the brewery. And when they were ranked as the number one brewery in the world, of course, thousands of beer lovers descended on the monastery. And the monks told everybody to go away, that they were sold out and they were praying now, which fascinated me. I love this story. And so I wrote a bunch of articles, and Mike Schwab at Dean Johnson had seen one that I think I had done for Forbes FYI magazine. And that's my background in brewing. I do have some passing understanding of beer from growing up in Indiana, and through the process of researching the book, actually discovered that I'm descended from an Indiana brewer named Ebner.
Really? You didn't know that prior?
I didn't know that. I had the oddest experience of sitting in the Vincennes Library looking at a early 20th century county history, looking for information on a brewery called Hack and Simon, and flipped a page and was looking at what I thought was a picture of my father initially, and then I read the copy and realized it was my great grandfather I believe, who owned this brewery that became a very large brewery. And it was sort of in family lore, the family had an old mansion in Vincennes that many brewers became very wealthy in back in those days. And I just was unaware that he was the founder of this brewery. He had been a French Foreign Legionnaire, an Alsatian, who came to Indiana and started a brewery.
Well, that's fantastic. You were able to tap into that. Okay, no more beer jokes. Anyway, so, I mean, during the course of this, I mean, I imagine, I mean, Douglas and Pat, the two of you must have had, you know, friends saying, wow, that's got to be the coolest job in the world, working on writing and designing a beer book. Ray, even though my question for you is, you know, as an editor at the Indiana Historical Society, was there any question for you about the validity of let's say, the history of beer in Indiana as something to address?
Well, once I knew that Douglas was involved in this book, I had no worries about the historical scholarship behind it, because we had worked together on a number of Traces articles in the past, which is the popular history magazine, the Historical Society. And as the page proofs came in, and I worked with Paula Corpus, our senior editor, who is now retired from the Historical Society, I was just amazed at the amount of scholarship behind this book. I now know more about beer from the early days in Europe until present time than I probably will ever need to know. And it's just a fascinating look at the growth of beer and the culture behind it. And I think Doug did a great job. And it's very readable. Not only is it a handy book to have in your car as you travel around on weekends, but if you want to know about Indiana history, there it is for you, particularly the early days of the beer culture in New Harmony and the Harmonists in the southern part of the state.
Yeah, well, the book is really, it's sort of, you know, two books in one, if you will, in that it is such a great history, a cultural history of brewing as well as a travel guide. The research had to be enormously fun and satisfying, I would imagine. Can you tell me about it?
Writing books should always be this much fun.
And it's usually not.
No.
And
no.
I'm guessing a lot of hands-on work here.
I did my part.
Yeah,
I think you're right. It is two books in one. It is a historical look at Indiana brewing. I discovered to my chagrin that there were actually more than 500 breweries in Indiana at one time or another, which I never imagined to be the case. And I have painfully researched most of them, but it's also a really in-depth look at the contemporary craft brewing scene here in Indiana, which is going through an enormous renaissance. There are more breweries in Indiana than any time since Prohibition.
Really?
Yeah. They're really prospering. They're opening more and more every day. You were just mentioning one that's opening called Flat 12 in Holy Cross.
It was just announced.
Just announced, and they're opening all over the state. I was really amazed at the quality of beer that I drank. Many people don't know that though I spoke with the Westvleteren brewery in Belgium that was ranked as the best brewery in the world, best beer in the world. The one that replaced them is a Hoosier brewery, Three Floyds, up in Munster, Indiana,
mm-hmm.
which was ranked as the best brewery in the world 2 years in a row. Their beer, Dark Lord, was ranked as the best beer in the world a number of times. And while that's certainly an eye-opener to think that a Hoosier brewery
that's
is the best
an amazing
beer in the
world. Story that doesn't seem to get out enough. I mean, best beer in the world.
The best beer in the world. But the thing that struck me is Three Floyds is not unique in Indiana. In terms of brewing world-class beer, Indiana breweries have won enormous numbers of gold medals and silver medals in world competitions and in national competitions. And I can testify, as I traveled around the state drinking beer, I was consistently,
yes,
absolutely, little tiny sips for the most part.
Mm-hmm, right.
I would say, just give me a splash of each one. I managed to get through this without gaining 50 pounds and, you know, mm-hmm. being stopped by people.
But as you were sampling these, excuse me.
The quality of beer is extraordinary, yep. and it is right here in Indiana. We really are doing something world class right here.
Now, Ray mentioned New Harmony, and I know that you were talking before we went on the air. We're actually recording this just right before the big microbrewery festival, and there's actually a beer that has historical roots that is being served there, but is also still available now?
Yeah. Through the course of researching the New Harmonist brewers, who were the first brewers in the state in 1816, if folks don't know who the Harmonists were, they were a group of several hundred German utopianists that came to what was then the frontier of Indiana and set up an extraordinary town on the banks of the Wabash. And being good Germans, they were, of course, our first brewers. They became pretty well-known brewers and actually exported all the way up and down the Ohio, all the way back to West Virginia, all the way down to almost to St. Louis. So they were big brewers for their day. And through a little bit of an accident and a lot of hard work, I managed to discover the recipe that the Harmonists used for one of their most famous beers, which would be today called a Schwarz beer, a kind of a black lager.
Okay.
It was in a there was an old book that the Harmonists had taken with them to their new home in Pennsylvania that was still in the library there. From there, both American and German beer experts helped us translate the old German Fraktur into contemporary German, and then a beer expert here in America was able to recreate the recipe. The cool part is the Brewers of Indiana Guild, they have brewed, 10 of the brewers in Indiana have brewed that recipe, so people can go and drink Indiana history. It is a remarkable thing that we've managed to connect the historical brewing in Indiana with what's happening with the contemporary craft brewing scene today.
Patricia, let me ask you, as your role as a designer with this, how did that play out? I mean, working with an author and were you involved with also, you know, I mean, collecting the photographs? I mean, certainly you design, you know, the book and the sidebars, and so it's a lovely book with a lot of great visual information as well. How does that process work with the two of you?
Usually I read the manuscript. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of meetings, interaction with the author to find out what he thinks is important and what needs to be highlighted with the art. And then I worked with a local photographer, Dick Spar, of Spar Photography, who took photos of the new breweries, the modern day breweries. Plus,
Sun King.
Sun King, mm-hmm. yes, and
not to play favorites, but it is.
which was kind of fun for him because he got to go around mm-hmm. Staten and take the thimblefuls of mm-hmm. of ale, and then. The fun part for me, because I'm a history buff, is I loved looking at all the old history photos and working with the Indiana Historical Society in their collection and gathering photos for that. Douglas was really helpful in finding photographs on his journeys. So it was just like a give and take between the author and the artist to get what's necessary into the book.
And then, Ray, what role does the Historical Society play in this in terms of publishing it and also, I mean, editing it or being involved in that process?
Well, it's a long process. We were able to, thanks to Monarch Beverage and its financial contribution, get the funds necessary to do the actual printing of the book. But it's round after round of page proofs that our staff goes through, checks for historical accuracy, makes sure everything's every comma is in the right place and every sentence has appeared, and all the usual grammatical stuff that an editor does. But also working with Pat on the design, tracking down photographs, illustrations from our library, as she's indicated, helping out with captions as well,
mm-hmm.
and making sure everything is in its proper place and it's available to go to the printer. And then now distributing the book through the Indiana Historical Society's History Market,
mm-hmm.
through usual online locations like Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, Borders, and just making sure that it's available for Hoosiers to buy and enjoy.
Patricia, do you know, has Dean Johnson done a project like this before with a sort of saying, we want a book, and so let's make it?
No, this was our first venture into publishing, and it was a growing, had growing pains. Scott Johnson was wondering, well, how long is this going to take? But it was fun, and we enjoyed it, and we hope to do more. I mean, we would really like to figure out how we can continue mm-hmm. to do it, because it was a fun project.
Well, no, as I've been told by Scott, it's two of your favorite things, right? Beer in Indiana. So.
And books.
And books, too.
So three of our favorite things. So.
In fact, I think Doug's already gotten a lot of emails from bookstores around the state trying to get him lined up for book signings.
Excellent.
Yeah. It's an incredibly popular subject.
Not a surprise at all. Douglas, I want to give you an opportunity to sort of have the last word here. I know, I mean, obviously you've already shared with us a couple great stories of things you learned through the process, but anything else that really sort of stands out, if you could pick something out that you really want to draw people's attention to as they're looking at the book, either a specific brewery or a really interesting bit of history?
The thing that struck me as I traveled around the state and met with the microbrewers in Indiana is how extraordinarily collegial they were, how they would support one another, and how I just never heard a bad word about another brewer. And that struck me time and time again. I think the events that they put on together, the Brewers of Indiana Guild, which is a consortium of all the, there's more than three dozen, I think, microbrewers in the state, the way they all get along and help each other get better
mm-hmm.
is one of the great parts of seeing, of just reporting on Indiana brewing.
Great. Well, on that note, I guess the only thing left to say to the three of you is cheers.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Travis DiNicola with author Douglas Wissing, designer Patricia Prather, and Ray Boomhauer, senior editor at the Indiana Historical Society Press. The new book is titled Indiana, One Pint at a Time, and it's available at the Historical Society, online at Amazon, and at local bookstores. Cheers. Hey, Travis, you know what's coming up in just a handful of days?
Oh, what would that be, Sharon?
There will be some big yellow vehicles
that corn dogs
come back onto the street, and there will be crossing guards.
Oh, I was thinking of the State Fair. You're thinking of back to school.
Well, that too, but
wow.
IPS starts on August 11th, so we have a solemn responsibility to get as much more fun in people's summers as we can on
What do we do? Well, something that I think is just going to be a ton of fun that's coming up. It started at the beginning of summer. It has toured through 115 events in 39 states.
Wow.
And it has just been going nonstop. And what is it? It is Drum Corps International. And the finals are going to be, once again, the World Championships are here in Indianapolis, August 12th through the 14th at Lucas Oil Stadium. If you have never been, it is certainly worth checking out. And they're doing a whole bunch of great sort of family-friendly and new events this year to encourage people who have never been to a Drum Corps performance before to come check it out. Great pricing. Check out dci.org for more information.
I had that on my radar screen, yeah. Too. A lot of fun. Here's something that is also fun. Grab your caftan. Yours might be
what?
In the back
Excuse
of the
me?
Closet. slip on a pair of gold sandals. Might be on your wife's side of the closet. And shimmy to the Art Center to dance the night away, because it's back. It's Art Sparkle, and this year there's a Moroccan theme. There'll be a Maharaja tent, sampling of food from the finest local restaurants and caterers, and lots and lots and lots and lots of fun. That's coming up August 21st. It benefits, of course, the Indianapolis Arts Center. Great cause. And it's a chance to dress up.
And shake your maracas.
And shake, yeah. No. You don't have to have a caftan or those gold sandals, Travis, if you want to go in.
How do you know I don't?
Well, yeah, I'm just saying. I'm giving you one out if you don't.
Gregory Hancock Dance Theater is wrapping up their summer series with American Classics, featuring dance performances or interpretations of Our Town, The Scarlet Letter, and The Crucible. Wow. So, if you certainly know those books from reading them in high school, then these are dance interpretations of them. If you've never read them and have to read them this year in high school, it's sort of like Cliff Notes on stage. So check it out. August 13th and 14th, 8 p.m. both nights, Pike Performing Arts Center. They'll be, dancing the Crucible.
And if you're an English teacher who wants to email us, it's at artofthematter@wfyi.org, but send it attention, Travis.
Fair enough.
Hey, sunrise, sunset, quickly flow the days and years. Oh, if a tune just popped into your head, then you need to think about going to the JCC on Sunday from 6:30 to 9:30 to participate in a first ever, but they plan to make it an annual event, interactive movie experience. You are invited to dress as a character from Fiddler on the Roof, and you are expressly invited to sing along. How cool is this? It's going to be amazing. It's going to be amazing. So, there are refreshments available there. It's family friendly, and I am getting a posse of people to go. So, come on out and enjoy.
No.
I'm just so fascinated
that
by this.
Like
it's kind of like Rocky Horror, but a little cleaner and more appropriate for families.
Wow. Sounds like a hoot. The Symphonic Youth Orchestra of Greater Indianapolis is performing Saturday night, August 7th, 7 p.m. at Cathedral High School Auditorium. These are really just great, great concerts featuring some talented youth, kids in our area, and it is Saturday at 7, Cathedral High School Auditorium.
Road Trip, Vivi, Indiana, August 27th through the 29th. It is one of Indiana's top 10 festivals. It is the 39th annual Swiss Wine Festival. There will be grape stomping. There'll probably be somebody from WFYI as a celebrity grape stomper. There usually is. Usually not us, but this might be the year we do it, right? There's a wine pavilion. And there are, in fact, activities for kids as well as grown-ups. The kids' activities don't involve wine, but you probably figured that out.
Sharon, I know it feels like the dog days of summer, but the IRT is thinking about Christmas.
Oh, no. Is this Auditions for Christmas Carol?
Auditions for Christmas Carol coming up August 10th and 11th. If you've got a kid or you are a kid between the ages of 8 and 13 who wants to be in this year's production of A Christmas Carol at the IRT, well, now is the time. They are having auditions down there at the IRT. Give them a call to get more information and sign up for an audition time. Should be a lot of fun.
The downtown neighborhood is trying to encourage people to come downtown and find out about downtown. So they've started this thing called Third Thursday Open Houses, and there's one coming up on August 19th from 4:30 to 6:30. There's a free Meet Your Neighbors reception following at 6:30 at a downtown restaurant. And you can find out more about downtown living, whether or not you already live there, at indiedt.com/thirdthursday. IndieDT.com/thirdthursday.
Hey, just a reminder that the Heartland Actors Repertory Theater is presenting Shakespeare's Two Gentlemen of Verona this weekend, Friday and Saturday evenings at 8 and then Sunday at 2 p.m. These are free performances down at the White River State Park, so drive down there right now and take a picnic and go check out Two Gentlemen of Verona.
That's right. Speaking of outdoors, you can go to the lawn at White River State Park. I know this is a dog days of summer calendar edition, but here's a trivia question for you. Our house is a very, very, very fine house with two cats in the yard.
Life used to be so hard.
Now everything is easy. Who's the band?
Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young.
There you go. And three of the four are coming to the lawn at White River State Park, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, on August 23rd.
That sounds like a great way to wrap up our calendar for this week. We'll be back next week with, I'm sure, some ideas for things to do at the State Fair. And who knows what else.
I see deep-fried food in our future.
Me too. Okay, we'll see you then on
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Passion, jealousy, romance, deceit, joy. The Indianapolis Opera has planned a season to encompass all of these strong emotions and more. Sharon Gamble spoke with John Pickett, the opera's executive director, to find out more.
Okay, I want to start not with the operas, but with the finances. You shared off mic some good news that you are finishing your fiscal year okay.
We are. We're going into our audit with, you know, the audit can always show you different things, but we're going into our audit with our books in the black, which was a huge achievement for us. People probably know that we had to take the difficult step of postponing the Mikado this past season, and at that time we were projecting we could have faced a $500,000 deficit, which would have crippled the organization if we hadn't done anything different. And between cutting costs and my board really getting aggressive at fundraising, we have landed in the black and are awaiting our audit the end of August.
That's an accomplishment worthy of an opera being written about,
It really is. You know, opera companies are facing a ton of stresses in this country right now. We know of at least 10 that no longer exist since the recession started.
Wow.
And it's because the most difficult revenue-to-cost model in the performing arts is opera. And so,
Why is that?
Well, when you think of opera, we're doing everything. We have a full pit orchestra, either the Indianapolis Symphony or Chamber Orchestra, in our pit, so we're producing a concert.
Mm-hmm.
We also, on the stage, are producing a bigger theater production than anyone else in town could possibly do, sometimes with 60 people on the stage in costumes, sometimes more than one costume in multi-sets. And then you add the professional stagehands and wardrobe union. We often, on a weekend of the opera, will have over 200 people under employment.
Wow.
So it's a difficult thing, and we were able to project, and people, the nice thing about it, Sharon, is when we postponed, we gave people several choices. 88% of our audience stayed with us, said we'll either keep our tickets or donate them back for a contribution. And the 12% that asked for refunds, I'm going to guess a third of the letters had notes. Don't worry, we'll stick with you. And we're starting to see that in our renewal campaign.
Congratulations.
Right now.
That's wonderful.
Thank you. I think it tells, if I've learned anything, it's that people have a passion for opera, and those that do want you to succeed. And there's a group of people, and I think it's growing, that want to see Indianapolis have a professional opera company.
You know, one of the other, before we move on to talk about the new season, one of the other ways in which you are a little different from some of your performing arts peers is that because when you stage an opera, you're not, it's not up for 3 weeks,
yes.
5 weeks, 6 weeks. It's one weekend.
Unfortunately, yes.
And if that happens to be a weekend of an ice storm or a blizzard or, you know, something else.
Or you're out of
so
town
exposed.
For some reason. Yes.
Or your audience, right,
yeah,
has other commitments. That
And our goal would be to be able to broaden that out, but we're working to build the audience and obviously the contributed income, because two-thirds of our income is from contributions because of the expense of the art form. Otherwise,
sure.
We couldn't have affordable tickets. We are doing a production, which we'll talk about later, that's going to have at least a two-weekend run, but it's not going to be at Cruise Hall this year. So that gives us an opportunity to start to broaden our footprint, if you will.
What's going on with the Basile Opera Center?
Well, that's exactly what I was talking about. We are in the process of developing an opera center named after Frank and Katrina Basile because of their generosity. It's the, people will remember it as where the Greek Fest was at 40th and Pennsylvania. We are taking over that building once the church moved to Carmel. It's a perfect rehearsal hall, great recital hall, great entertainment space. Our offices are moving there. We'll have a chance to broaden our education outreach. We're planning to have a summer opera camp for kids.
Really? Cool.
And I'll tell you, the artists, we've rehearsed 6 operas there now, and the artists that come turn to us and say, this is as good a rehearsal facility as they have. The acoustics are great.
Wow.
We can put an orchestra and the singers in the room that we rehearse in. It's really a great situation for us, and will help us make a leap forward.
And for somebody who's not doing the math while listening, it also saves you the expense of having to rent someplace to
not
rehearse.
Just the expense, but also the embarrassment, if you will. We were having to rehearse in one of the buildings at the state fairgrounds, which wasn't climate controlled.
Oh, I'm sorry.
In the winter, if we heated it, it would become so loud that we had to turn off the heat. And when the singers got cold, we'd stop rehearsal and heat the building up again. And likewise, in hot weather with the air conditioning. And so just to be able to have rehearsals, and let alone have rehearsals where we're officing, makes a whole different synchronicity, if you will, for the company. And I think people in the long run will see the results of that.
All right. We've whetted their appetites enough. What's the season?
Well, we're opening with the Mikado. We promised people we would. So October 15th and 17th at Clues Memorial Hall, we'll be producing Gilbert and Sullivan's best operetta. Everyone says that. The Mikado. We're very excited about it. Great cast. Every one of the cast members that we had cast originally, and most importantly, the stage director, were able to do it except for 2. And we're very fortunate. Bob Orth, who's a fabulous singer, was our first choice originally. Couldn't do it. Now he can. And a great character mezzo by the name of Susan Nicely is coming to do the Catashaw, and she would have been a better choice, too. So we're very excited about that. And then in March, we're doing our first production at the Opera Center. We're doing what's called The Tragedy of Carmen. It's Carmen, the story, the music of Bizet. It was adapted in 1984 by Peter Brook, who is one of the great directors in the country. It won a Tony Award at that time, played for several months, almost a year on Broadway at Lincoln Center. I call it the psychodrama version of Carmen. There's no chorus. It's reduced down to the 4 main characters and 3 actors.
Ah.
And it will provide an immediacy because people will be so close to the singers. We're bringing top-notch singers in for that. And I think will be a special experience. We're running that on starting March 11th through the 20th, 8 performances.
What's the seating capacity there?
We're building a 300-seat flexible
perfect
situation because we know this. Joachim Schomburger, who's directed for us before and has an expertise in virtual theater design, mm-hmm. is designing it, so it's going to use projections and so forth. And I think it should be a lot of fun. Yes.
Wow.
I'm looking forward. And then we're concluding the season. Last year, Mikado wound up on our season because of a People's Choice program mm-hmm. we ran with our audience. And it ran neck and neck with another opera. And so when we announced the Mikado, we promised this season we'd do that. So we're closing our season with La Traviata, Verdi's great opera. Wonderful cast on its way. If anyone saw La Boheme last season in November, Maureen O'Flynn, who is really one of the great interpreters of opera in the country, is coming back to do the soprano lead in La Traviata right after a Met contract. And then Richard Paul Finck, who we got at the last moment to do our Das Rheingold with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra last May, who is a big find, just literally left the Met from that production to come to ours. Asked us, begged us. He said, I'd love to come back to Indianapolis.
Really?
So he's doing the Germone, and then we're still waiting on the tenor to tell us if he'll accept the contract or not. So we have a really great season
what
ahead.
What a great compliment, if you think about it, that you, a collective you, have built this program that is high profile enough that and professional enough and distinctive enough that singers want to come.
You know, and the thing that people in Indianapolis don't realize or don't know is that across the nation, people talk about us a lot. Within weeks after our Das Rheingold, within days practically, we were getting calls from all over the country going, wow, tell me about it. I've heard about it. It's a very small network,
sure.
Opera is, obviously.
Sure.
And we have a really great reputation. One is because of the city. people here are so open, so hospitable, that our singers like coming here. And we really work at having a reputation as a company that works at treating singers professionally and having the best professional environment, because I think people need to realize we don't bus and truck these shows in.
No.
They are built and produced in Indianapolis. The professional leads come from all over the country, sometimes from Europe, come here for just 3 weeks to produce this show. Chorus is local, orchestra is one of the two I mentioned, and it's done here. It's not a show that you might see at Clues or the Murat that's brought in here on a national tour.
Mm-hmm. And those singers who are coming in are going back out and spreading the word.
Oh,
well,
they are.
The next place they sing.
We had several years ago, I laughed, we had some people may remember, we had a Faust that was sort of doomed on opening night. The man playing the devil pulled on us, and we had to fix it over that weekend. And with Jim
Carraher. I'm laughing. It wasn't funny at the time.
No, but I'm laughing now. But Jim Carraher and I left the next day to go to our National Opera America conference that happened to be in Houston. We barely got in the airport and ran into people, and they're like, tell me what happened. I mean, we got there, and everyone knew what had happened,
and that was
24 hours later. So it's a small network, which is a good thing sometimes.
What percent of the audience comes from outside Indianapolis, ballpark?
You know, I'm going to guess maybe 5%, somewhere between 5 and 10. We have subscribers from all over the state, plus 6 different states. People like to travel for opera because if you're doing something that's not done often, they'll come for it. Or if there's a singer they follow or something like that. So we have pretty good outreach. And then our outreach program last year, I think if I'm right, reached 48 of the 92 counties in the state.
That's no mean accomplishment.
No, it isn't. We have this great, and every year it's better, great group of resident artists that we hire in January on a 5-month contract, and they do school programs and community programs and programs for us. But they really do provide a statewide and beyond impact for the company.
Indianapolis Opera is taking over the Midwest and then the country.
I don't know about that yet, but we're working towards being the best we can possibly be.
Sharon Gamble with John Pickett, Executive Director of the Indianapolis Opera. Learn more at indyopera.org. That's IndyOpera.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4. I'll find out how the Indie Fringe and the Young Actors Theater are collaborating on a new project.
I'll get a chance to talk with actress Priscilla Lindsay before she heads off to her new job as the head of the University of Michigan's Theater Department.
And I'll take a look at Native American Heritage Day. And, of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call What'll We Do?
So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.